and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I am your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Arvind Sanger of Geosphere Capital Management. Arvind is a wealth of knowledge on the sustainable energy transition. He had stints on the sell side. He was at SAC for a while. He now runs Geosphere. He is a heck of a guy, and I enjoyed getting to know him through this process. This episode is sponsored by DeLupa. I use DeLupa. I like DeLupa. DeLupa is probably more than I personally need, but it would be great for an institution. It's got every single data point from every 10K, 10Q, earnings release, earnings transcript, all the things. They input the numbers into an Excel model for you. You click on a cell. It takes you directly to where the number is cited off of. That helps me contextualize the number that I'm actually looking at. Occasionally, my brain gets the units mixed up, or I realize that the units are slightly different than what I thought they were. Then, every time that there's an update on the model, I get an email to my inbox. So I find it to be a heck of a way to get up to speed on companies, industries, and they make my life easier. I think that they have a strong likelihood of saving your organization time. So if you are at an institution, I would highly encourage you to check out DeLupa if you're looking for some sort of comprehensive data provider. The other thing that's super nice about it is you don't have to worry about transposition errors, which is not my strongest suit. Anyway, I digress. As always, nothing in this episode is investment advice. Everything is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions and do your own due diligence. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy the episode. Ladies and gentlemen, thrilled to be joined by Arvind Sanger. I am very excited for this conversation. I have, in preparation, been watching some of your videos and very excited to have a discussion about energy and the smart energy transition with you. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Bill.
Yeah, well, thank you for coming on. Do you want to give people a bit of a background on yourself? I think it's quite a story, and I was fascinated when I heard it, and I think my listeners will love it as well.
Well, happy to do that. Well, you know, look, I've been doing this for longer than I care to admit. I was an energy sell-side analyst for 15 years. Switched to the buy side in 2002. So I've been doing this for managing money for, almost 21 years. So, you know, I have a 3.5 decades under my belt looking at stuff that, I invest in sell side and energy and a little bit in shipping, and now investing what I would loosely describe, although we use a different label, but I would loosely describe as natural resources and related equities.
Now, when you say that you switched to the buy side, you went to a shop that's fairly well known.
SAC Capital. So I went to SAC Capital, was there from 2002 to the end of 2006, early 2007. I left to join, to start my own fund, which is called Geosphere Capital. And we launched I was running a $1 billion book at SAC when I left. I started with a $10 million book. So I had fantastic growth there, probably the fastest growth of any portfolio manager in the equity side there during my, 4+ years. And then I launched with $1 billion, quickly got up to $1.5 billion, and ran that fund, focused on, similar things, energy and natural resource equities and industrial equities. And I had a good second half of 2007 when we launched in mid-2007. Didn't get hurt too much in the 2008 drawdown. We were down 6.7%. And then, in the decade of the 2010s, we felt like we were swimming upstream because energy and metals and mining were generating negative returns during that decade, while NASDAQ and anything associated with that was flying and S&P was doing quite well. And so, return all the outside capital at the end of 2018, shut the fund down a few months later, and kind of was, doing some other things, but basically doing a lot of personal investing and sitting on the sidelines until I had the aha light bulb moment in the spring of 2021, and they decided to launch this new fund, which we call now the Sensible Energy Transition Fund, which is basically investing in again, everything that comes out of the earth, whether it is energy or resource related, and betting on the fact that ESG and energy transition are creating some unique set of opportunities. So that's what we do today.
When you were at SAC, you know, was I think whenever somebody goes on a run like I think you went on, and I mean, you started managing 10 million and ended up at a billion, so presumably it was very good. It sounds to me like some of your career is a function of obviously being smart, but being in the right place for that first kind of run, and then the next decade was tough. And now I hear you talk. I mean, we've talked. We did a pre-call, and then I've gone through your investor letters and I watched a couple of videos. There's an excitement in your voice that I think is a little bit palpable when you speak. And I wonder if you're not thinking that maybe there's another run ahead of you. Is that a fair way to characterize what's going on?
Absolutely. Look, I've been around the commodity businesses for a long time. And what I've seen is that these cycles last a long time. And these cycles have different drivers. And frankly, you know, it's only in hindsight you realize sometimes what were the drivers of the cycle, how unique the cycle was. So if I look at the early 2000s, when I first got to the buy side, the drivers of the cycle were twofold. One is that we were at peak oil, so we were running out of oil. So oil went up to $147 a barrel in early 2000 or summer of 2008. And the other was that China led demand boom as China was industrializing. And that was benefiting other emerging markets, which were supplying the resources that were needed for China's boom. So there was a virtuous cycle there. But, you know, there was capital flowing in and other non-commodity economies, India and others, also did very well. So this was an emerging market-led boom where emerging market equities did very well. Commodity equities did very well. And NASDAQ and S&P 500 struggled. So this was a decade which had a kind of a unique flavor where, you know, everything that we were doing, which was investing globally and investing a lot in emerging markets because that's where the resources were, and investing in, energy and metals and mining worked beautifully. And I guess it's only in hindsight we realize how uniquely, you know, kind of great confluence of circumstances drove that level of outperformance, where I have a chart which I have in my presentation which shows from the beginning of 99 through the end of 2007, during those 9 years, the energy and metals and mining, a couple of indices that we use, were up sixfold. Whereas during that period, NASDAQ and S&P 500 had a total return cumulatively of in like a 30 or 40%. So there was a huge amount of outperformance. Now, you know, when we go to the beginning of 2010 to the end of 2019, that decade, 10 years, energy and metals and mining were down 30 to 50%. While NASDAQ was up fourfold and S&P 500 about 2.5-fold. So you had the two mirror images. And clearly, I wasn't smart enough to foresee how bad the decade of the 2010s would be for, China changed its growth model from being very, very energy and commodity intensive, particularly the commodity, the housing, the infrastructure. They slowed down the spending. They slowed down the, crazy growth or growth rate, and the demand growth slowed down on the commodity side, and that drove a pullback in metals and mining. And what happened in energy was what was peak oil till 2007-8 became glut of oil by 2014, because suddenly the shale oil revolution of the 2010s caused a floodgate of new supply to open up from the US. And while in hindsight, the energy companies did not earn their cost of capital, but they convinced themselves that they were all chasing this profitable, rainbow of shale growth. And I'd like to joke that it became a race between who would turn $20 into 19 faster in the energy business. But it was
19
really,
wasn't so bad. I think it was closer to 10 or whatever. Right?
Maybe that was it over time. And it was all at, low single digit at best return on capital on a car industry that was hugely reliant on and spending 100% of their free cash flow and then some. It was the number one issue of high yield debt, the energy industry in the 2010s in the US. And they were also frequent issuers of equity to fund this growth in volumes, but that huge, detrimental impact for for investors. And so, you know, while the energy demand story did not have any meaningful deceleration between the decade of the 2000 and the 2010s, the supply side was completely different from where production was not growing to where production was growing faster than demand. And all of that was being driven by, you know, shale oil production growth. So that became the second era. And the reason I'm excited is because I'm seeing, a third cycle in my investment career from the buy side, which is, you know, no two cycles are similar, but as they say, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes, and it's rhyming beautifully right now. And there are elements of supply growth which are driven. Last time it was you were running out of, you know, oil and there was peak oil. This time we're unwilling to invest in new oil because of ESG or because peak demand is around the corner, so nobody wants to risk investing in new oil projects, or because ESG investors have convinced them that that's an evil thing to be investing in fossil fuels. In the meantime, the demand for oil is not going away as fast as the, you know, as those who are hoping for a faster energy transition seem to be betting on. It's clearly not going anywhere near that pace. And therefore, we think that this is a cycle that is going to be demand still growing, maybe more moderately than the past two decades, but supply much, much more challenged for many fossil fuels. And for the first time in my career, this time, the metals cycle was, you know, maybe coincident with the energy cycle, but the drivers were, you know, somewhat different. They were independent of each other. Yes, if China is growing its infrastructure, this time you can't go fast enough in energy transition without finding more copper to allow the energy transition, without finding more lithium, without finding more uranium, which we believe is important for energy transition. So as you're going to try to switch, look, I drive a Tesla. I used to drive an internal combustion engine car. My internal combustion engine car used oil. My Tesla uses coal or natural gas or nuclear or wind or solar. So, you know, you're switching your fuel source, but electric is not a fuel source. So the question is, as we're going to these other fuel sources from oil, A, we're not going fast enough because a lot of emerging markets are still 100% internal combustion engine growth in car sales. But B, we have to figure out which of these supply sources are we going to use. And all of them require mining. And that just becomes the bottleneck for the speed of this energy transition.
One thing that I have perhaps incorrectly had an aversion to is the argument that like ESG is the reason that there has not been much investment in the oil patch. It seems to me that a more likely explanation is returns were so poor for 7 years or whatever that investors, and it seems to me like COVID happened and it gave everybody a chance to kind of reset and say, okay, How do we want to go forward now that we are sort of like restarting and the conversation, and maybe I'm getting my time frame a little bit mixed up, but it seems like it's more of a shareholder pressure issue than maybe an ESG issue. Is that incorrect?
I think it's absolutely right. If you look at, you know, a lot of energy companies, U.S. shale-focused companies, went bankrupt in 2015, 2016, when oil went to, you know, sub $30 a barrel. And then in 2017, they again started drilling like crazy, and oil again crashed in 2018. So at that point, and there were some who had not gone bankrupt earlier who went bankrupt again, and then, you know, some more went bankrupt in 2020. And what ended up happening is after that 2018 and 2020 crashes, frankly, after 2018 crash, the debt markets were turned off for good for the high yield market for the energy business, and the equity markets closed too. And after the 2020 crash, you know, it became pretty clear even to the boards of the energy companies that there was no appetite amongst investors to fund growth. And in fact, the investors were clamoring for cash return from surplus cash flow. So what you had is that, you know, couple of crashes, and then the final, crash of negative oil briefly in 2020. The high yield markets shut the door window, the equity investors shut the window, and then the boards said, fine, our incentive now after 2020 is going to be based on cash return to shareholders, not just capital discipline, but also returning surplus cash to shareholders through dividends, because this is not an industry, and this is where the ESG pressures and the energy transition pressures came in. The conclusion that now everybody came to share is that you can't count on growth of long-term demand to be overinvesting in this sector.
Okay.
And you need to start thinking about energy transition. Therefore, it is better to limit your growth ambitions and to return that surplus cash to shareholders, because the world doesn't need your oil. So it was a confluence of everything coming together that really has created this perfect moment in the energy business.
So maybe the way that my brain needs to think about it is ESG and politics has created the incentive to accelerate the renewable investment, which has then got the oil companies saying, well, we don't know what the demand looks like, call it in 10 years from now. So why are we going to continue to grow now when it may not make sense, right? So let's return excess capital to shareholders. And at a minimum, you know, the worst case scenario is oil price spikes, we all make a lot of money, and then we figure out what to do next.
Well, oil price did spike to $110, $120, $125 briefly for a brief period in early 22. But the good news is that the energy companies did not budge. They just took that surplus cash. And anytime an energy company announced increase in CapEx, their stock price would take a hit. Anytime they announced an increase in cash return to shareholder, the stock price would go up. So, you know, the Pavlovian kind of response is now well in place of increased cash flow does not mean increased spending. But I will mention one thing. Do not completely dismiss the ESG effect on oil company investment. If you look at the Europeans, Shell had a decision at The Hague by an activist judge saying that they had to reduce their CO2 output by 40% by 2030. These governments all came up with, under pressure from their shareholders, the ESG investors, their governments and others, to set aggressive CO2 reduction targets. And in the last month and a half, BP and Shell have actually walked back their aggressive CO2 reduction targets and are reinvesting somewhat more in oil and gas than what they've done.
I will not dismiss ESG. Europe is interesting. I was just over in Scotland, and the amount of wind farms that they're investing in had some of the people on my trip very upset, because they said this is such a waste of resources. And, you know, you've spoken at length with people about the smart energy transition. And I'm curious for your read on, you know, renewables and baseline and what is reality as we go forward? I mean, I know storage is a real issue, right?
Well, yeah. Look, Europe made a big bet on renewables even before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So if you know, there's a chart that I use, which compares European natural gas prices to Brent prices. And European natural gas prices traded with Brent. In fact, many of the contracts were linked to Brent until summer of 2021. And in summer of 2021, gas prices started blowing out. And by December of 2021, while oil prices were, in December of 21, I think oil prices were around $80 per barrel, natural gas prices got to $60 per MMBTU, which is the equivalent of $360 per barrel. So gas prices went from being, you know, $15 in the spring of 2021, or $12, or $10, they went to $60. And the reason that they completely divorced from the underlying oil price is not because Russia invaded Ukraine in 22. This was in 21 we are talking about. The reason was that Europe had low natural gas inventories because they had a cold winter, the winter of 2020. They had deficient rainfall in 21. So the hydro output was low. They had, Germany was shutting down nukes, so nuke output was falling. But most important and most alarming was that wind did not blow as much as expected in 2021. So the idea that just because you put renewable, you can count on it, wind doesn't blow the same year over year. There are times when, so 2021 was the first time that people realized that just because you wind, there's one thing to say that wind only blows a few hours a day, but over time it'll normalize. It's another thing to say for months on end, wind blew less than expected. You can store wind when you have too much wind blowing and you have enough demand and you can put it out later in the day when the, but you can't store wind for 6 months.
Yeah.
If the wind output is low, you can't store hydro when the hydro output is low for the time when you had good rainfall. So the problem with renewables is not just a storage problem. Solar is generally better because sun generally does shine reliably a certain number of hours, different seasons. You know, you can sometimes get these wildfires in California or the one that we had in Quebec, which caused New York to have smoke and whatever. So there are times when solar can surprise on the downside, but I think the surprises, shocks have been less, but none of these is baseload. Baseload power is when you need it, it is guaranteed to be on. That's coal, that's natural gas. Some places, but almost no place, use oil for power generation. You can, or it's hydro. The hydro is baseload, but again, hydro seasonally, sometimes rain doesn't fall, then in the dry season, you don't have enough, and then it's nuclear. Of all those, we now consider hydro green, although in the old days, it used to be considered terrible because you build these dams, you displace communities, you submerge trees, but now we consider it green because it's quote unquote renewable. But nuclear is just being classified in the last 10 days as equivalent in Europe, as equivalent to wind and solar, because they're now finally coming to their senses that nuclear is your reliable green baseload source. And so, you know, the wind, yes, it's nice that they're doubling down on wind, but wind cannot be baseload.
Yeah.
And it's a storage problem, but it's also a reliability problem.
So nuclear is something that I have heard about since, I want to say 2016, I started hearing the uranium pitch on how it was the inevitability, but there have been so many political problems. It's nice to see now people are possibly open to it. Do you think that there's the political will, even if it is objectively true that nuclear is like green baseload, do we think the citizens are going to get aboard, or is there too much of a fear factor involved in that?
Well, look, I've been fortunately, unfortunately, investing long enough that I've seen cycle in almost all these commodities. So I was involved in uranium in the early 2000s, mid 2000s. Uranium prices got to $140 per pound in 2006, 2007. And we owned a number of uranium stocks. We actually even own physical uranium. You can't own it in your office, but yeah, we own it in a conversion facility called ConverDyn, and we owned physical uranium in 2008-09, and then we sold it under long-term contract to utility when we saw the returns were very good, buying in spot and then contracting out a term. Fortunately, we got out of most of our uranium positions. Prices started falling, but the death knell for uranium in that cycle was a Fukushima disaster in 2011. And that caused, a number of Japanese nukes to shut down. That caused Japanese as a buyer to disappear, and the prices crashed. And between that and everything else, and the Germans announced after Fukushima in 2011, and Merkel announced in 2012 that in 10 years, we're going to shut down all our... So that was the goal by 2022. They were going to shut down all their nukes for the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Agreed to extend two of their remaining nukes till March or April of 23, but convinced that nuclear is bad. So nuclear did go through this period where it went out of favor. And people like the Germans and, a few other Europeans joined them. I think the Austrians, others, who became anti-nuclear in quite a strong way. And so nuclear went through that phase. I think what people started talking about, the early thinkers in 2016, 17, Bill Gates was one of them. They started talking about nuclear has to be part of the green transition mix. But most investors said no. Europe said no. In 2021, end of December, when gas prices got to $60 per MMBtu, the equivalent of $360 per barrel oil, in December of 21, under great pressure because they were realizing the folly of going all renewables all the time, they decided to reclassify natural gas as a transition fuel through 2030, meaning EU governments could invest or provide incentives for projects through 2030, and uranium through 2040. They still thought it was not green enough, it would be transition. 2 weeks back, under pressure from the French, they now classified it equivalent to or to wind and solar as being completely green.
Oh, interesting.
So it's taken multiple shocks to get there. It's so uranium, you know, has a long way to go. But what is really exciting to me, the problem with uranium or with nuclear is it takes 10 years between approvals and safety checks and building a new plant. And then the costs are prohibitively high and there are cost overruns.
Yeah,
and
they always run over.
Whatever. But what people forget is that there are hundreds of nuclear reactors in the world operating safely. And that is the new model, because every nuclear submarine has a nuclear plant, power plant. A lot of aircraft carriers have been built in the last several years, which have nuclear fuel stores. And these have had zero accidents. No nuclear sub has had a nuclear leak. They may have sunk, and then there's fear that after the nuclear sub sank, what is going to happen? But actually, the safety record of that is impeccable in terms of nuclear leaks from submarines or ships. So what we are now seeing is adopting that technology called SMR, small modular reactors. And these small modular reactors are much built in such a way that much more fail-safe, so the runaway reaction risk is lower because anytime it interrupts, the first thing is it shuts off. To actively keep it on rather than actively turn it off.
Oh,
so
interesting.
It is an active turn it on, so the default is off. Works is it's much safer in terms of nuclear accidents, and the we still haven't solved the problem of what are we going to do the waste, and that remains the one challenge. But I think these small modular reactors are faster, and you can build one. I want to build a new green steel plant, right? Steel is made from coal. If I want to build a new green steel plant, people are talking about building a new green steel plant with an SMR next to it. So your source of energy is green nuclear power. And then today we have electric arc furnaces, which don't require coal, but that electric arc today comes from electricity, which comes from natural gas in the US or coal in China. Now, you know, Poland and some other East European countries are talking about steel plants, which will be based on SMRs. So you bypass the fossil fuel completely. It'll take 6-7 years even then with SMRs to get there, but I think that could be nuclear. We can get the time frame shorter, we can get the safety better, and we can get modular small reactors, so you don't have these big, but you can build industrial plants around SMRs.
How big are the waste pools?
It doesn't matter whether it's an SMR or it's a big reactor. The waste is a function of how much power it generates over time. But I think, I will admit I'm a little over my skis in knowing the exact amount, but we've only created a few thousand pounds of waste in all the nuclear reactors in the U.S., and we're just trying to figure out where to put it. Nobody wants it in, anywhere near them, but the reality is that it is a very small, manageable amount. It's not even the size of, one of our waste dumps in Island, which are taking New York City waste. It's way smaller than that. It's compact, where it could be one small storage facility, or one small, not even the size of a Amazon distribution center for all the nuclear waste in the world. So we just have to figure out ways to put it in places that in a desert or wherever, to store it in an underground cavern. Well, I do not think it's an insurmountable problem. It's something that I think people haven't said what's going to happen if it ever leaks. And I think, the reality is we have to deal with irrationality too. Human beings have their fears, and we have to deal with it.
Yeah, I had the bright idea in my head of shooting it into space. That's why I was curious if it was small enough to put it in a capsule and shoot it up. But
you could.
Yeah, I don't know.
You could.
This is half-baked ideas here. But I have heard of nuclear for a long time, and I was reading a report last year, and I kind of, you know, natural gas seems like such an answer to me. And I think it's funny, like, you saying that my Tesla is powered off coal. I mean, I have some friends in Denver that tell me that they're green because they drive a Tesla. And it's kind of like, well, isn't your power grid kind of coal based or not? I don't know. But, I think it's interesting. The part about the transition that I guess has me a little bit concerned geopolitically is it seems to me that all of the further processing for batteries and whatnot resides in China. And maybe that's wrong, but I think most of the raw materials are located in countries that maybe aren't friendly. They may be, I'm not sure, but like the Congo, for instance, and then the further processing is in China. I mean, am I worried about the right things, or am I completely off base on this?
No, you're absolutely worried. I mean, so, you know, what the Russian invasion of Ukraine did, in addition to showing the Europeans their over-reliance on Russia for their energy source, natural gas, they were getting a lot from there, and now they're desperately trying to diversify away. The other thing that it showed is the issue of energy security. Suddenly, everybody's concerned about that, and now we are looking at China as an adversary. And I'll be honest with you, the dirty little secret is that we were happy to shut down our rare earths mine and rare earths processing in California and let China do it, because it was quite a chemically dirty process.
Yeah, it was a dirty process. Let them do that.
To do the processing of the rare earths. So we were happy to outsource it to China. And, you know, and the reality is that a lot of the stuff that we, you know, let them take the, you know, the lithium from, actually lithium is found in friendly places too, Australia, Chile, South America, wherever, and let it go to China to be processed, you know, we don't have to worry about it. But now we're realizing that, you know, security supply chain, if we have a repeat of what happened with Russia with oil and gas for Europe, today 70%+ of all processing of rare earths, of lithium, of cobalt, these are all required in, you know, energy transition, or of solar manufacturing of solar panels and everything associated with that. 70% plus, you know, 70 to 80%, 85% of all these come from China. We are jumping from where 27% of the oil and gas production in the world comes from North America, for us in North America, US plus Canada, to where 70, 75% of all this energy transition critical material comes through China. And that is a huge energy security risk.
Who was the gentleman from MIT that you interviewed that made the point that energy, the abundance is geographically spread out, and so is the refining capability, whereas the difference is with some of the batteries, you've got the processing is in China. I thought that was a really interesting insight that, you know, with traditional fuels, there are many places that have the ability to both extract and refine, but when it comes to battery technology, not so much.
That's right. Yeah, Bob Armstrong, who's the head of MIT's energy transition department, we had a webinar with him and we talked about that, and he said exactly that energy security right now, refineries are all over the world. Oil and gas is found in many places. We worry about the Middle East. Middle East is 26% of the world's oil and gas supply. Middle East is 26%. Now let's look at, you know, rare earths and then it gets processed everywhere, right? They send the oil to refineries in Europe, refineries in US, refineries elsewhere, and we have our own oil, so we don't, you know, we do export some in commodities, that it's a much more secure market for us. Europe is still reliant on imported oil, but they have their own refining. In many of these other things, not only do we not have the resources, we don't have the refining either. So it's much diversified, and we have to bring it all. And so, you know, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act that the U.S. Congress passed and President Biden signed last year is recognizing that problem and is providing incentives for onshoring of tax onshoring of critical mineral processing, as well as mining, onshoring either in the U.S. or in friendly countries with which U.S. has a free trade agreement. But there were supposed to be two bills that Senator Manchin had wanted to pass. One was the one that became the Inflation Reduction Act, but the second one was a permitting bill to fast-track permitting for projects, both conventional fossil fuel and energy transition, and that bill did not pass. And so the problem you have is you have a tax incentive, but you have an approval process which involves multiple constituencies, some of which, look at the extreme example. We have the largest gas resources in the world sitting in the Appalachian region, the Marcellus Shale, which is in western Pennsylvania, south Pennsylvania, and southern, southeastern Ohio, parts of West Virginia. We have it in New York State, although New York State does not allow drilling for that shale gas. And yet, Boston, Massachusetts, and Connecticut have to import LNG from Trinidad.
What?
Because New York State will not allow a pipeline to be built across from Pennsylvania to Connecticut.
Oh, that's bananas.
So last year, U.S. consumers were paying $6 or $7 for natural gas, landed maybe $8, and Boston, Massachusetts, they were buying natural gas at $50 and $60 because of the permitting issue of New York State not allowing a pipeline. So this, think of this multiplied when we find hydrogen somewhere, and hydrogen is far more explosive than natural gas, or we have offshore wind farms, and then you need to build transmission lines to take the power from those offshore wind farms to somewhere, in the away from the shore, and we need high tension transmission lines. And Maine voters just voted in November of 21 against allowing transmission lines from Quebec, which has green power, surplus green power with their hydro, down to New York and Massachusetts and other New England states, because they don't want the transmission lines overhead. So, part of the problem in energy transition is the permitting problem. And the permitting problem has already existed. We are seeing examples of it in conventional, like the gas one that I told you, or in the transmission lines for renewable power that I just told you. And now we have this Inflation Reduction Act, which provides its tax incentives, but we don't have the accompanying some rationalization of our approval process to make sure that, that if we have these green projects that people are trying to put up, there's not an endless, battle to get all the permits needed to make it happen.
This reminds me of post-2008 when we had the infrastructure bill or whatever, and getting it done was a real problem because they didn't have the permitting, right? So I mean, is the long-term, it's interesting. I was going through the, I believe it was JP Morgan just had an energy conference, and I've been listening to some of the energy companies getting ready for this discussion. And a lot of them, their comments are, we have no idea what oil does short term, but medium to long term, we're pretty constructive on the price. And I'm wondering if the reason is the supply dynamic that you outlined earlier, combined with just the feasibility and the probability that we actually transition to whatever the new grid may or may not be. It just seems to me that oil is going to have and natural gas is going to have a very long, or a high probability of having a long runway here. It sounds like the transition's a lot easier on paper than maybe it is in reality.
Yeah, I mean, China's demand growth is going to be, maybe 10% this year, but that's unusual because the demand growth was depressed last year because of zero COVID. So that's not a fair. But China's demand growth beyond this year, despite the fact that, you know, 30 plus percent of the cars sold in China today are electric cars. So they are almost two-thirds of electric cars sold in the world are in China.
Almost two-thirds, you said, right?
Of the entire, you know, on all the countries in the world, China is that important. And China's demand growth, China is the second largest auto market in the world. I think it's still a little smaller than the US, but electric cars, it dwarfs everybody else. And yet, even beyond this year, we expect China's oil demand growth, with the first station, the oil demand growth will still be 2 to 3%. Now, here's the problem. India's demand growth year to date is about 6, 6.5%. And it is accelerating. And there's almost zero electric cars sold. They're 5 years behind the US, 10 years behind China in terms of electrification of grid, because, you know, the grid needs a lot of, because you can't, you know, you have to have surplus power. You have to have the, they're power deficient countries. It's easy to import cheap oil from Russia or from Middle East or whatever, and then use that for transportation. Switching to power means, you know, right now it's a coal dependent grid, and they've been adding solar power, like, you know, very fast. There'd been a lot of grid and solar grid growth, but at 7 o'clock in the evening, they have energy shortage. They have power shortages. Because then everybody gets home and plugs in their phone, turns on their TV, turns on their air conditioner, and imagine if they want to charge their cars. There's going to be, you know, there is no power. So my point is, if that demand is now starting to accelerate, and India today is probably on its power consumption trajectory, maybe where China was in the early 2000s, maybe 20 years behind on that. Even if we are generous and say they're only 10 years behind China on electric cars, they're 20 years behind on their oil demand growth. So the oil demand growth is just about to accelerate. If everybody goes to charge their electric cars, the local substations are going to blow out. What China is doing is spending a lot on upgrading the grid, because the grid load distribution becomes very much times because everybody's charging their cars or whatever. So as you do that, you have to supplement your electric grid. And so these are all practical problems that we don't talk about, that the Inflation Reduction Act does allow for it, for the grid and the, you know, new charging network. But it's still easier to do, put up a bunch of chargers. It's much harder to upgrade the grid. It takes a little more effort. And that's what's going to be required. So my point is, going back to the oil argument, the oil demand growth is going to continue because these countries are much further behind on having the grid capable to meet their existing needs, leave alone having a whole new charging network. So this demand growth for fossil fuels is not going away. And, you know, you can't tell a person in India who's coming into the middle class that, hey, you can't drive a car because the grid is not ready and we're not going to sell you an internal combustion engine car because that's evil. We've been driving internal combustion engine cars for decades, but you know, poor lower middle class Indian are not allowed to own a fossil fuel car. That's not going to happen. Or an air conditioner or a smartphone, which needs to be charged at 7 o'clock in the evening. And if there is no sun shining, then what do you do?
Yeah, you've got to have a grid that's capable of powering the peak usage, right, without failing. So is this a little bit what Elon talks about, where he wants to have a grid that you can kind of put power back into the grid? I mean, like, in a, I'm not.
Yeah, he's talking about storage. Yeah, he's talking about storage. But basically what he's saying is, if you charge your car during the day and you can power up your house at night when your car is parked. But, you know, yes, we should be able to do some of that. But all of that assumes that we're able to time our uses and charging and uses alternative times, right?
Yep.
But the reality is that, you know, that if I'm at, you know, at work during the day, do I plug in my car then and charge it? And is everybody then turning on their air conditioners in their office? Is that, you know, am I having a shortage then? And then I go at home at night and then I'm doing, you know, in an ideal world, we'd be able to cycle through all of that perfectly. But there are practical difficulties in doing that, that, you know, our behavior is not conditioned to where it can fit perfectly into now I charge, now I discharge. And during, you know, peak demand hours, I'm discharging, and during peak supply hours, I'm charging, right? That would be the way the Elon dream would work. So, you know, it's great in theory. In the practical reality is, you know, we go to work at a certain time, we go home at a certain time, we're not working in shifts around the clock, and therefore, you know, those things don't work quite as well because we're all doing the same thing at the same time usually.
Yeah, that makes sense. It seems like a lot of what I read that you discuss, and when I watch the talks that you give, you're very focused on the supply side. And it reminds me of the guys at Marathon that talk about the capital cycle theory, right? And there's some, like the market, does the market assume that supply is going to come online? Like why are these stocks screening so cheap if the fundamentals for say oil or even copper being so tight? Like it seems to me, I watched lumber for a bit, it seems like when you have these tight conditions, crazy things to the upside can occur. And it also seems to me that the current free cash flow multiples imply that the crazy upside just did occur and we're going back to normal. And I'm curious why there is a disconnect and how you manage through that and what you watch to say, okay, you know, this is, I think this is going to continue versus it's time to cut this trade. Curious how you think about that.
Well, you know, I'll tell you a little joke. And I remember a cartoon that somebody had on their wall, which stuck with me, which is, you know, it's showing a TV announcer, presumably CNBC, saying that the news came that a meteor is going to strike the Earth in 7 days. And so the, market crash, and then the Fed announced they were cutting interest rate and the market rallied. So, you know, we know that we have a problem, but, you know, short term, we're just worried about what the Fed is going to do.
And who cares if the media is coming in 7 days? They cut rates.
Yeah. And so we're in that environment today. We're in this environment where we are, you know, so focused on, we had this little scare, but now it's like, you know, AI is going to save the Earth. They're going to save everything. Fed is going to engineer a slowdown and a perfect landing. China is, clearly not going to grow again much. So therefore, we're going to be fine. Oil prices are not going up. Copper prices have come down. Oil prices have come down. Gas prices have come down sharply in Europe because the gas, you know, they avoided the gas crisis. You know, they've had two back-to-back warm winters. The market is now extrapolating that all these problems have gone away. We have solved nothing structurally. We've had two warm winters in Europe. We've had one warm winter in US. Again, notwithstanding climate change, there is no way that you can say that every year is going to be a warm winter. That is not at all anybody's case. And therefore, you know, we have to watch for that. We have to watch how much of the economic slowdown is behind us and ahead of us. And if we are going to accelerate this electric car, everybody's choosing electric cars, the demand for copper is going to accelerate dramatically. Now, you know, on the metal side, there is one big issue. 50% of world steel, copper, aluminum, zinc demand in the last decade has been coming from China, close to 50%. And China has been driven by two things. It has been driven by the commodity demand, two big drivers. The two biggest drivers have been housing and infrastructure. And housing was driven by people moving to cities, young people entering the workforce, and speculation.
Yeah, those ghost cities were wild.
Yeah, President Xi has been very clear that he wants housing to be for living, not for speculation, right? So if you assume 10, 15, 20% of the demand came from speculators, it'll never go to zero, but a substantial portion could disappear. The sharp drop in young people, if China's demand, if population is declining, its population of young people is at a rapid, because it's not like old people are dying. It's just that the young people, because of the one-child policy, that cohort is declining rapidly. So the demand for new housing, just from people, you know, whatever, if you assume they buy houses first house at 25 or 30 or whatever, that population is shrinking by, you know, 20, 30% over the last 5 years. That's been a dramatic decline. So the demand for housing is going to structurally be much lower going forward. That's a headwind for all metals. And that's been a big adjustment. The good news is the adjustment is behind us. They new housing starts in China are down 40, 45%. So they've overcorrected for this two factors. So we are now, in my opinion, at a new baseline from which it's not like we got to have another leg down to adjust for the speculators going away and the fact that the new people entering the workforce is going down. So we're now such a sharp drop. We are not counting on a big rebound, but from here it should be, you know, kind of a stable. So that bad news is already in the metal sector. At this point, the electrification demand, China's copper demand is up this year, unlike its demand for steel or other commodities, because their electric car sales are up 30+% year to date. And so the electrification, the electric network, the cars themselves, the grid upgrades, that's driving the copper demand, not wiring and housing, not infrastructure. The other thing is that they've been building physical infrastructure, bridges, roads, tunnels, airports, subways. That, again, it's not going to be growing from here. The rate of investment in that will shrink, but the rate of investment in wind, solar, electric upgrades, that's going to grow. So it's a handoff from what was very cement, steel heavy to being more copper metals heavy and some other rare earths. So there's a change in the mix in China and the rest of the world. We have our own infrastructure bill, which means we're going to build out the infrastructure. We have our own Inflation Reduction Act, which is supposed to encourage investing in renewables. So we and Europe are all going into the copper, you know, at breakneck speed. So I think the adjustment on the big drop in China has happened. That's again given people comfort that there's no problem. We'll be able to manage energy transition. But I just think this was a one-time drop. And from here, energy transition is going to be very copper intensive. It's going to have a component of aluminum because we need to lightweight electric cars. They're much heavier. Batteries are much heavier than the engines. So therefore, we're going to need to use lighter weighting, which is aluminum. So these are some of the metals that are going to be big winners in energy transition. And then, as I said on oil, I think China's demand, the big growth is behind us, the zero COVID 1 year boost. Our demand has slowed down. Europe demand has slowed down. Shale is still on its last hurrah. And here's where the main point I would make on shale. Shale growth is, in my opinion, we're in the eighth innings of the shale oil production growth. And when that party ends, we're really going to be in trouble from a long term, because a lot of companies are laying down oil rigs this year in the US, private companies. Why? Because they're running out of tier one, as it's called, inventory. So tier one inventory, which is economic at $65, $70 oil, is running out. We're going to need $80, $90, $100 oil to make tier two inventory economic. And we're going to, and so we're keeping on running out of that. So I think that what we are in is this kind of period where we are all assuming that we've dodged the bullet and everything is okay. But the reason that people are bullish on this medium to long term is, notwithstanding the short term factors that have come together to create a bit of a headwind for demand, the demand side is not going away. And the supply side, I think there are real headwinds to copper long term, political and geological problems for copper, because copper grades are falling and most of the copper comes from Latin America, and they're going through their own political upheavals to go more left, to go more in increasing taxes, increasing redistribution, and therefore the companies are reluctant to invest. And then on oil, I think the shale side is running out. So, you know, long answer, but I think we are in a decade where these ebbs and flows, in my opinion, just sort of pause before the next leg.
So you got 40 to 50% of copper is coming from Latin America. Interesting. So in my head, which is probably wrong, it seems like there was like a decade of real growth and then this big pocket of overinvestment and malinvestment. And then Like, how long are these cycles typically when you think about them? Do you think about length, or are you looking at just supply and reacting to what you see?
Yeah, I think about length, and you know, every cycle ends with something. I think this cycle will end, in my opinion, if you would have asked me, I'm guessing, I will know it when I, hopefully I'll know it when I see it. Yeah, I'm not, but I think this will end with some significant breakthrough technologically, either a new storage medium, which significantly allows us to, you know, store electricity much more cheaply than the current, lithium ion batteries or some other ways to store wind or solar. We have some breakthrough on, new sources, or we get, which might be a little longer, we get nuclear fusion working or something like that, which really, changes the equation for energy. I think this energy transition will not end with overinvestment by oil and gas industry. That is absolutely, this time will not be that end of the cycle. Usually you get, overinvestment. Everybody, rig count in the 70s went through the roof, overinvestment at the same time. Same thing happened in, that was in the 70s cycle when we had inflation and oil prices went crazy and rig count went crazy. And in the 80s, supply grew and demand started to, we started buying smaller cars and demand fell off. In 2000 and, 8, 9, we had all this. Then the shale oil came along. So shale oil was the technology that we didn't see when we were worrying about peak oil, which caused that last cycle. And we had a brief demand destruction because of the global financial crisis. But after that, demand came back, but the shale supply. So we'll have a recession. We'll have that demand. We might even get it right at the front of this cycle. We may have other demand shocks down the road, but on the supply side, it's not going to come because we suddenly find new ways to find copper, new ways to find oil. It'll be we find new ways to transform other forms of energy. And I don't know when that's going to happen, but that's why I talked to the Bob Armstrong at MIT and others, because they're at the cutting edge of some of the technology frontiers of what's likely to come. And I don't think there's anything that's, he said that he expects nuclear fusion to be commercial. There's a company that came out of MIT, Commonwealth Fusion. He expects the first commercial nuclear fusion to be ready by 2035. So that's a little beyond my investment horizon. So I'm not staying up nights, but there will be something. I don't know what it is, but I don't think there's anything imminent because I'm watching all the different technologies. There's nothing that's a breakthrough. People are praying that hydrogen will be the answer, but hydrogen is not a source of energy. It's a store of energy. And so the question is, will it be that much better store of energy than the batteries today are? And then how do we transport hydrogen? That is the biggest challenge. Even if we can get the cost down and can get cheap hydrogen from wind or solar when we have surplus as a store of energy, better store of energy than lithium, how will we get the hydrogen to where it can be used? And that's a huge challenge, both from a liquefaction of hydrogen, if you want to transport in liquid form, or from a gaseous transportation of hydrogen, where hydrogen is far more explosive than natural gas, and moving it long distances is extremely challenging.
You don't think that pipeline approval for a highly explosive gas is going to be easy?
Yeah, imagine that. Imagine that.
It's interesting. It's funny. I obviously, my mind was blind to, I wasn't blind, but I was so like, oh, oil and gas is a bad business because of the past decade and what I'd seen. And frankly, like even people in the industry that I've talked to, I talked to somebody, a CEO that is a offshore servicer. And I said, what keeps you up at night? And he said, well, there's 800 years of oil and gas not being rational. So should those years come back, that's what keeps me up at night. But, last year I heard a lot of calls for oil at 200 and here we are, at, I think it was like 68 today. And that's within 3-5% or whatever of the 5-year average. And I can't help but wonder if there's a potential second bite at the apple here.
You mean in terms of, new supply coming on?
No. I mean, it's interesting that the market may be providing
an opportunity.
Yes, that's right. And I don't know. I'm just kind of trying to revisit my priors and think about where I was wrong before and where I might be wrong now.
Yeah, I mean, look, most of us are surprised where oil prices are this year because China reopening, U.S. strategic petroleum reserve, big drawdown behind us, and supply growth in U.S. shale starting to decelerate a little bit, and then potentially Russian supply being challenged by sanctions and what have you. These four together were supposed to result in much higher oil prices. But the reality is a couple of surprises. Russia has not lost any production. Iran has been able to get more production back in, beating their sanctions. And demand has been, you know, China and other places have been somewhat lower than expected, including the U.S. Even though we may not be in a recession, our demand has been quite modest. That those have been the surprises so far. And shale oil production is okay. It hasn't fallen off quite as much as I had expected it would. But, you know, none of these are structurally changed. Structurally, shale oil is on a downward slope in terms of growth rates. Demand from China may not be, you know, may not have lived up to expectation, but it's still going to continue maybe at a slow pace. But India and others are picking up pace. Structurally, U.S. demand is not going anywhere. It has maybe taken a breather here because of whatever slowdown, but I think U.S. demand is pretty stable. So we'll see. I'm bullish on oil, but I'm not betting on any big move. I prefer to have the frog slowly boiling in the water. Not, I don't want the frog to be dropped in too much hot water and have a big demand response, because one of the things I fear about is if commodity prices go too far too fast, one of the ways the cycle can be truncated is accelerated demand responses. So in a sense, I prefer moderate commodity prices and a long extended runway of profits.
You'd rather get rich slowly than have one good year followed by not so good years.
Yes.
Yes. Well, that's a wise take, in my opinion. When we, well, actually, here's a question. How do you miss, and I don't mean miss, because you didn't miss, you avoided the decline in natural gas. Was it last year that you were writing about? You kind of saw what was going to happen. I'm curious how you put that together and solved that puzzle.
Well, you know, like in anything else, there was also a little bit of luck involved. I mean, you know, I would like to pretend our foresight is always 20, but, you know, what ended up happening is that we saw the supply growth in the U.S. You know, people were getting excited last year that U.S. gas prices were $5 and European gas prices were $50. And then, you know, 50 went to whatever, 100. And so there was this huge discrepancy, and people were saying, I can buy cheap U.S. gas, and U.S. gas price went from 5 to 6, 7, 8, 9. What people were not paying attention to is that there was no transportation to, these are two disconnected markets unless you can move from one to the other.
Yes.
You can't arbitrage that difference, and there was no LNG new
which
export
capacity. Which requires
like
another
out.
Chenier or something, right?
That's right. The LNG export capacity, and the LNG export capacity is coming on end of 24. 25. So we were seeing this U.S. gas production with high prices encouraging U.S. gas production growth, and yet no supply growth coming on. So we felt that this was a risk that investors were jumping on the bandwagon without understanding that just because Putin has turned off Russian gas to Europe doesn't mean that U.S. shale companies benefit. Gas prices ran up to 9. Then you had this one Freeport LNG facility, which was one of our second largest LNG facility, which had an accident, and then it was shut down for 6 months. So you had one, you know, possible another constraint on moving gas from U.S. to global markets. So you again further stranded, and then we got lucky that we had a warm winter, so it accelerated everything. So U.S. gas prices went from 9 to 2, and I wish I had shorted the commodity, but I shorted some equities. And the equity, the E&P companies came down, but they never discounted 9. They were discounting 5, and then they came down to discounting 250. So we made money on that trade. And then we shorted some U.S. oil service companies because we bet that you know, the rig count would drop as these gas prices came down on the gas. The positive surprise is the rig count has dropped on gas drilling. The further positive surprise is the oil rig count has dropped. So these companies have come down as rig count has dropped. Clearly, they're the one thing that they've done well, which is better than I expected. So far, the U.S. oil service companies have managed to be more pricing disciplined than in past cycles. But I worry about whether that can sustain. But their demand is coming down and there is some pricing pressures. Therefore, that remains a point of caution for us, although we may be in the seventh or eighth innings of that trade playing out. But what continues to surprise us is the oil rig count is also going down, which comes back to my shale point that, you know, at $60, $65, $70 oil, a lot of, you know, tier two acreage is uneconomic, which was not the case 2 years ago when we were drilling these wells at $60, $65, $70 oil. So something is changing at the margin, and that's bullish for oil long term. But so we avoided in fact, in the first quarter when energy was down 4.5%, our best performing sector in our fund in the first quarter was energy because we made a lot of money on our shorts, which we happened to be, you know, short the right stuff that went down a lot.
What changed to make the tier two acreage no longer economic? Is it labor constraints or like commodity inflation? What would drive the uneconomic nature?
I'm not sure if it's tier two acreage became uneconomic. There are two answers to that. One is that most of the drilling has been in tier one acreage. One of the things that has happened is we are running out of tier one acreage. So we are switching to tier two acreage. And what is different now versus pre-2019-20 is we are no longer tolerating below cost of capital drilling. So between the fact that we are no longer tolerating below cost of capital drilling and that tier one ton acreage is running down, tier two acreage, as we're seeing that and we're realizing that we can earn a cost of capital without much higher oil prices, that's becoming much more apparent. I think the first answer is more important than the second, because the reality is that we were not drilling tier two acreage even back 2-3 years ago, but we had, because we had so much tier one inventory, why would you go to tier two inventory? And now
we got to think about it.
We're running out of tier, so now we got to think about tier two inventory. And then we got to evaluate it in the new. So the thing is that the juiciest part of the shale is starting to run out of room.
Yeah.
It's not over yet, but it's starting to run out of room.
Something that you said that you wish that you had shorted the commodity. How do you think about those, you know, the trade-off of going to the futures market and just shorting the outright commodities or getting long the commodities versus the equities? Is that a mandate issue or is that a risk tolerance issue?
It's more my comfort. I mean, I've been an equity guy all my career. So I do trade commodities. My most successful commodity trade and my one that saved my prior fund in 2008 from having a bad year. From having a terrible year, I was down 6.7% in that fund.
I think that's a pretty good year in 2008. But that's my opinion.
it was a good year. We were in the top, I don't know, quartile, decile, whatever, of funds.
I think a lot of people would have been very happy with minus 6% in 2008.
But what really saved our year that year was that I bought put spreads on crude oil. When oil got to 147, I kid you not, we were very lucky on that day. We started buying put spreads. We sold $175 calls at 147 oil and bought $125 put spreads. And then as oil rolled over, I kept rolling and increasing the size of my, it kept rolling down. And that, I saw a big gap. Equities had sold off by 2008. Oil was keeping on going up. These are dangerous things to short term, they can stay done so extreme that we kept some of our equity longs, but we made a big short bet or small short bet, which became much bigger on crude oil. And crude oil went all the way down to $20 or whatever in the global financial crisis. And that really is what helped us, in our portfolio. So it's not like I don't do it, but it's not my first choice. And it's not the thing that I'm most comfortable doing. And I usually use puts to minimize my risk because I'm not good at managing the huge volatility risk of going outright on the futures market. I don't have experience in doing that in an aggressive way. I may do small amounts of that. So therefore, equities is our main thing.
That makes sense. When I couldn't help but hear that you say that you rolled it down and pressed the bet a little bit, and I, you know, think back to your training grounds at SAC and, I kind of wonder how much of your success do you think is leaning into your winners versus like picking a lot of good winners? I'm just kind of curious, you know, portfolio management, I think leaning into when you're right is such an interesting concept. And, you know, I'd love to hear you riff on it if you don't mind.
Absolutely. I'm a strong believer that, you know, you got to make, you know, big bets on your winners and kind of press them when you think you've got it right. So in the first quarter, just as an example, our three largest positions in the first quarter of this year, our three largest positions were three energy companies. Energy index was down, I think, 6-odd% in the first quarter. These three 9% average positions in the first quarter were up between 16 and 20%. These were our three biggest positions, and these were longs. We made money on the, if it came from the short side, but these three really caused our long profits to be very, long losses to be very small, because these three large positions we made a big bet on. The other large longs we made smaller bets on. We spread it out widely. And these three, so, you know, an old discipline, and one of the things that I guess I learned early on in the SEC days and portfolio management is you try to keep your, you know, your low conviction bets where you have the highest risk of, you know, losing money. You always have a risk in everything, but, you know, you keep them small and you kind of are ready to kick them out if they're not working. Whereas your conviction bets, and the conviction bets being that large is not an SEC training, but I've been running a long only small fund, which has helped me in kind of being patient with positions and being willing to pay, take a little bit of pain, but sitting through those. And that's been, you know, we've had this one position in Tidewater, which I've talked about in, you know, one of the interviews I did with a publication. And, you know, it's a position we've held for the last 6 months through thick and thin. It's still it got up to above 10%. We took a little bit off. It's still a 9% plus position. And, you know, it's been a phenomenal stock in the last 6 months. It's still got, you know, in the next couple of years, I hope we will make, you know, 60-70% or more on it, because I think it is still an undiscovered, underfollowed, unloved stock in a sector that I used to hate. I used to cover it on the sell side. And I remember one of my most favorite reports of one of my most memorable reports of all time I did was called the Tidewater Dilemma, of why both companies were structurally screwed because they all had to add new capacity. So I had this huge view on this, and it took me complete 180 to realize that something had changed and nobody was willing to finance new boats. And nobody was willing to build new boats, and the sector was ready for a cycle as offshore activity picks up. So, you know, we have to find these you know, gems which are not dependent. I don't care whether oil prices, and I use Brent because offshore globally is Brent, not WTI, which you referred earlier. Brent prices are in the low 70s, but I don't care whether Brent prices are 65 or 100. This story is going to work. Now, if Brent prices went to 50, but I don't see that on the horizon. Therefore, this bet is, you know, based on not on a price call, but on a bottom-up bet. So, you know, some of our more exciting ideas are bottom-up bets, not making a big call on the commodity, but on companies and their specific fundamentals and how they will play in this energy transition. Because, you know, again, I was at a shipping conference and the ship company said, you know, I was hoping that the ship companies would say, which I invest in shipping, that no, we can't get any financing. They said, no, we can't. The banks are still willing to give us financing because to be ESG compliant, they've shut off the oil fields service company offshore supply boat companies. So the sacrificial lamb for the shipping companies to build new oil tankers or product carriers or dry bulk is that has been completely abandoned. And that was the best thing I heard that day. That made me say, let me go buy more Tidewater. Because the minute the financing is turned off, I know that this Tidewater dilemma, which I wrote about 15 years ago or 20 years ago, is now turned into the Tidewater opportunity, because nobody's willing to finance new boat construction.
Huh. Interesting. Do you know Bob Robotti?
I have not met him yet, but I'm hoping to have a conversation with him. I know he's a big fan.
He's great. He's great.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you so much stopping by and dealing with the technical difficulties. I've enjoyed the conversations. I enjoyed our intro and I enjoyed this one. And I want to be mindful of your time. I asked until 3 minutes from now, so I'm going to let you out of here a little early. But thank you so much for coming on, and I hope it was enjoyable. If people want to follow your writing or get in touch with you, how can they do it?
Well, I think we do have an email ir@geospherecap.com, and that would be the most easy way, or my head of investor relations, Evan Newman, and he's evan@geospherecap.com. Those would be the ways, geospherecap.com. So those would be the ways to get in touch with us, and happy to, you know, to engage with anybody getting, you know, on our mailing list or our webinars.
Webinars are great.
Yeah, well, our next one is going to be by a provocative old friend of mine who has written something about energy transition for the other 7 billion, meaning that our energy transition has been designed for and built by the top 1 billion in the world, the rich, the, you know, the armchair critics and all who want the world to be the way that they think it should be, while the 7 billion at the bottom of the food chain around the world, especially in emerging markets, have different aspirations and needs, and why the way we are doing energy transition is not going to work for them, and therefore they're going to insist on it working for them in a way that may not be the way that the poor politicians and the businesses are planning and the ESG investors are planning energy transition.
Well, I am going to make sure that Evan has me on that distribution list, because I look very, very much forward to that conversation. And thanks again. And on behalf of the listeners, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely necessary.